supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, and in that time, America really has become more green. Recycling's mainstream, and more of us are thinking about energy efficiency. Certainly, one of the big environmental issues today is climate change. Most national polls show that most Americans see global warming as a very real problem, but don't feel threatened by it. As a nation, we're far more concerned with other big issues like the economy or terrorism. So why is it that we don't really seem to care about climate change? Is it all about our psychology that makes us respond to certain threats and not others? Well, on today's show, we're going to take a look at these issues with Robert Gifford and Anthony Lizerwitz. Gifford is a psychology professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He also served on a special task force of the American Psychological Association on psychology and climate change. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Anthony Lizerwitz is a research scientist and runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. He's one of the principal investigators for the Global Warming's Six Americas study, which measures Americans' perceptions of climate change. He's joining us by phone today. Also, Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, later we're going to hear from Dan Gilbert. He's a professor at Harvard, a cognitive psychologist, and author of Stumbling on Happiness. He'll be able to tell us about how our brains really aren't evolved enough to handle certain threats. Well, in the meantime, we want to hear from you also. Call us and tell us how you feel about climate change. Is it urgent? Is it not? Are you doing something about it? Are you not? And why? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Anthony, I want to start with you.
Sure.
The latest poll you did showed that the percentage of Americans who don't think global warming is happening has doubled since 2008. Why is that?
Well, to give it a little more context, we find that the number of Americans who believe that global warming is happening has dropped about 14 percentage points from 71% of Americans back in the fall of 2008 to about 57%, so just a slight majority as of last January. Likewise, we find that those that believe that it's human-caused has dropped by about 10 points from 57% down to 47%, so just slightly fewer in a majority. And likewise, the level of worry out there in the country about the issue has dropped about 13 points over the course of the past year, from about 63% of Americans who were worried in the fall of 2008 to about 50% who are worried as of January.
Is it something like the AIDS crisis, where the moment it went off the news as a crisis, people started ignoring it and going back to their old behaviors?
Well, I think this is actually a great example of a perfect storm. There have been a whole variety of things that have all converged at the exact same time that are driving public opinion all in the same direction, one of which you already alluded to, and that's the impact of the economy. People are very, very worried out there about not just the state of the economy, but unemployment more specifically. And, you know, that's very real. That's very tangible. That's very much in people's lives. Many people know people or themselves have lost their job or are concerned about losing their job. And we see that in public priorities. The economy by far is the largest priority in terms of national issues. And that has pushed climate change and other issues, in fact, right down the priority list, even right off the table. So that's certainly an important piece. A second really important factor, however, has also been the media itself. This issue is invisible to most of us. I mean, you know, most of us don't see the carbon dioxide or the nitrous oxide or the methane pouring out of our buildings, our cars, our cities. I mean, if we could only see it, you'd see these giant billowing clouds coming out of all these sources. But we can't see it. And as a result, climate change is out of sight and out of mind. And thus, the media plays a really important agenda-setting role. It reminds us of this issue. And when it doesn't report it, it's just less available to us to think about. And we've seen that media coverage has dropped in newspapers to only about a third of what it was
well,
a couple years ago.
You know, the media, by and large, has kind of the mind and attention span of a toddler. So, you know, we're always looking for the next crisis.
That's right.
You know, to follow around. I want to look at this a little more closely. You've been trying to figure out in these polls who's been saying what. So in your Six Americas study on global warming, you found six groups. And at one extreme, excuse me, you've got the group that you're labeling dismissive. And on the other group, you've got alarmed. So when you talk about these overall statistics about, you know, people are less inclined to be worried about global warming, is that across all of your groups?
It's across a number of those groups, and you're raising a really critical point, and that is that we tend to talk about the public. But the thing is that the American public does not speak with a single voice on this issue. It is not a homogenous, monolithic block. I mean, we know this about every other issue, and climate change is no exception. There are, in fact, based on our work, we've identified six distinct Americas within the United States, each of which responds to this issue in a very different way. And as you said, I mean, one of those groups is called the alarmed, and we've seen that even the number of people in that group have dropped pretty significantly from about 18% of the public in 2008 to about 10% today. At the other end of those six Americas, at the other end of the spectrum, you see that those who we called the dismissive have increased from 7% of the public a year ago to 16% now. And a large number of those are people who basically believe that climate change is a hoax or even a conspiracy.
Can we make any generalizations about these groups? Do they break down according to geography, according to class, economic status, race?
Yeah, that's one of
education.
The most. You're right. That's one of the most interesting things about this is that yes, there are some demographic differences. There are some political differences, like you might expect. In other words, the dismissive tend to be more conservative Republicans than the alarmed, who tend to be more liberal Democrats. But what's particularly interesting about these categories is that, in fact, these six Americas are not explained beautifully by those demographics. It's really much more about the issue itself. What do people know about it? What do they believe about it? What are their underlying feelings and emotions and values, and how do those affect how people perceive the issue as well? And you know, I'm sure we'll get into that in much greater depth over the hour.
If you just turned on the radio, we're talking about we're talking about global warming, climate change, and specifically our attitudes about it. How many of us believe that it's happening? And what affects our attitudes? So we'd like to hear your thoughts about global warming. Is it happening? Is it urgent? Do we need to do something? Are you doing something? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I want to one more question of you, Anthony, before we turn to Robert. What intrigued me when I looked at your report was that the majority of people in all six groups you surveyed said that developing sources of clean energy should be a priority for the government.
That's right, and that's what's so interesting about this as well. So even with all the declines that I've just talked about, people who don't think it's happening or that it's human-caused or that they worry about it, all of those have dropped over the course of the year. But nonetheless, we find that Americans across the board, across all six Americas, across Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, everybody supports a number of the exact same policies that would be required to deal with climate change. And that's because we think that they tend to support the exact same things, like funding renewable energy research. 85% of Americans support that. And that's been consistent for years. And yet they support that policy for very different reasons. The people we call the alarmed or the concerned are supporting it because they're concerned about the environment and about climate change. But the people who we call doubtful or dismissive about climate change support that exact same policy because they're concerned about national security and about the fact that the country is dependent on foreign sources of oil from countries that aren't particularly freedom-loving. So the point here is that this is what politics is all about. It's about strange bedfellows, finding ways to get very different groups to agree upon the same policy, though for perhaps very different reasons.
Well, it's about what politics is all about, but it does raise an interesting question about the human mind and how that works. So I want to turn to Robert as an expert on the human mind. So, Robert, let's talk about the APA task force study that you were involved with, studying the connection between global warming and psychology. The APA cited a Pew Research study that found most Americans, in fact, according to the Pew study, did think global warming was a problem, but when asked about what issues were most important in their lives, they ranked global warming last on a list of 20 big issues. The economy, jobs, and terrorism, no surprise, were the top three. So what does psychology or cognitive science tell us about these contradictions, this one in the Pew study and the apparent one that Anthony just talked about?
Well, I think Anthony is on the right track in terms of the problem being distant and invisible in some ways. And your point that the media tends to hop from issue to issue with today's news, which is legitimate, of course, in some ways. I mean, the ash cloud over from Iceland, that's what's happening for 500,000 travelers today. And the economy, of course, in the States is not doing very well. But the main problems are other issues in the way we think about problems and the way we try to get past certain problems that are in front of us by dealing with them in psychological ways. I should say that, you know, some reasons for people not doing something about climate change are structural. You know, there are people who are poor, there are people who live in places where it's hard to do something about their behavior because of the infrastructure of the city they live in, etc. But there are also psychological barriers to doing things as well.
Such as, I mean, the APA reports found many psychological barriers that keep us from feeling a sense of urgency. But a couple of those that stuck out to me were denial and habit.
Yes, well, I started off with when I was doing interviews like this several years ago with six or seven what I call dragons of inaction, and they started multiplying so much that they turned into like 22 of them now, and that's a kind of an unwieldy number. So now it's interesting, this number six with Anthony. There are now six genera of dragons, and certainly habit and denial are important ones. Skepticism. I've noticed that lately my esteemed friend who is a skeptic has begun calling those who believe in global warming warmists.
Well,
my wife likes this term. She thinks it's kind of a nice, cozy term.
Well, wait.
But anyway,
you know what? I'm going to interrupt you for a second here, Robert,
sure.
If I may, because we've got a caller on the line, Lars, who is not convinced of global warming, and I'd like to hear him weigh in on
sure,
the discussion.
Sure.
Lars, hi. You're on Voices. You there?
Hi there. Yeah, I'm here.
Hi there. So, talk to us. Tell us about...
Yeah, so I'm a PhD chemist. I've done a lot of research, not in global warming, but in chemistry generally. And there are definitely two sides to this story. And there's a UK Channel 4 documentary. I'm from the UK, as you can hear, called The Great Global Warming Swindle. And the message is that the media assume it's happening. and then the scientists need it to happen to to get their research funding. And actually, what is really the case is that CO2 is following the Earth's temperature rather than going ahead and causing the Earth's temperature rise. And the important thing is that global cooling happened between 1940 and 1975, when there was actually quite a large rise in CO2. So I think we need to look at the sun as to why the Earth is warming. And we need both sides of the story, really. That's my view.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call. And so here's a scientist weighing in, and he sounds pretty dispassionate to me, you know, objective, and he's waging an argument. And he's got a lot of meteorologists who agree with some of what he's saying anyway.
Right. So, well, it's not a matter of two sides in my view. Although I'm not a climate scientist either, I do trust the most respected ones. And the point about needing to get research grants is a bogus one, because there's money driving both positions. The skeptics or deniers are well known to be funded by oil interests, etc. But the truth of the matter, I think, trying to be as objective as possible, is that the climate has multiple impacts on it. El Nino, etc. There is a solar effect. So it's not one or the other, but what it is that the short-term climate, if you can imagine a graph, is going up and down slightly over time. But if you draw a line through the up and down curve, it is definitely going up. Carbon dioxide can do nothing but help to increase the average temperature over the longer time period. So to point to one of the downs in the curve or the up, or to point to other factors, is absolutely correct in one sense, but there is no way that the amount of CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere cannot gradually, slowly, over time, increase the average planetary temperature.
Anthony, one of the questions in the Six Americas study is, what is the first thought or image that comes to mind when you think of global warming? I'm curious about what kind of answers you got.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. It's a kind of a free association test that we use. And so historically, we've always found that one of the first things that comes to most people's mind is melting ice. In other words, ice shelves breaking off in Antarctica, sea ice retreating in the Arctic Ocean, glaciers melting. And then when we ask people, what's your affect, or what's your positive or negative feelings, which turn out, by the way, to be one of the strongest predictors of how people perceive the risks of this issue and what kinds of policies they support, their underlying emotional response to this issue, we find that people think that melting ice is a very bad thing. The problem is that most Americans don't live anywhere close to the Arctic Ocean. They don't live in Antarctica. They don't live near melting glaciers. So this, again, it's been very helpful in terms of helping people understand that climate change is happening. We all have had the experience of taking a glass of ice out on a hot day, and what happens? It melts.
But wait a minute. Let me interrupt you here. So most of us don't live near Alaska, or wherever else great glaciers are up in the Antarctic, but I wonder if people in Alaska tend to be more in the alarmed group.
That's a great question, and in fact, I did a whole study in Alaska just a few years ago, because the question was, to finish the point, most Americans think of climate change as this distant problem. It's happening somewhere else on the planet, not here, not home. And distant in the future, you know, a generation out or more, not happening now. And yet, if you look at the Arctic is warmed 2 to 4 times as much as the rest of the planet. And it's already having very significant impacts across the Arctic and including Alaska, which is part of the United States. So I did a study in Alaska, and basically what we find is that Alaskans are more convinced that climate change is happening. They were more convinced that it's a serious problem for the state. But they were not necessarily any more worried about it than the rest of the country. And they were not necessarily any more likely to support policies to deal with it than the rest of the country. Now, that's where, again, the population characteristics turn out to be really important, because, of course, Alaska is a very red state. very conservative, very Republican, and in that sense predisposed to be skeptical of anything associated with environmentalism. Mm.
Let's see if we can get one more call in before we have to take our break. We've got Richard on the line. Richard, hi, yes. You're on the air.
Yes. My comment was on the old psychological principle of out of sight, out of mind. And I think that's one of our problems with CO2 is we don't see it. Someone had mentioned that earlier. If we simply took some measurements from our larger smokestacks and gave it a yellow tinge, that would probably help to bring the point across. The yellow tinge would have to be related to the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere. I think maybe the other aspect, too, is working around greenhouses. I see the effect of CO2. It's in the growth of plants. Now, you won't see that so much outside of a greenhouse, but there's no doubt about it. When you have extra invisible CO2 in the atmosphere in a greenhouse, you just see the plants go wild. Hmm. That's it.
Thanks for your call, Richard. I wonder what can be done. I mean, both you guys, and I'll turn to you, Robert. Both you guys agree that it does need to be more visible, but what can be done realistically to make it more visible? Certainly numbers don't help.
Well, we just conducted a study here where we asked people to think about the issue and showed them some images that were either based on the local regional impacts that are expected and the more distant or global impacts. And as you might guess, and I think Anthony would probably have predicted as well, when local impacts were made more salient, people were much more concerned and much more willing to do something about it than when more distant kind of impacts were displayed. Well, and this is a kind of a controlled experiment with the same population.
Well, after our break, I want to talk about that whole issue of thinking locally versus globally, and it works for so many other factors, including the economy. So, like I said, we've got to take a short break. We're going to be back, and we're going to hear from Dan Gilbert, psychology professor at Harvard and author of the bestseller Stumbling on Happiness. And, hey, we'd love to hear from you. Is climate change on your mind, or is it just too overwhelming or scary, or are other things just more important for you? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. My guests are Robert Gifford, professor of psychology at University of Victoria in British Columbia, member of the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Psychology and Climate Change. I'm also joined by Anthony Leiserwitz. He's a research scientist and runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. He's one of the principal investigators of the Global Warming Six Americas study, measuring our perceptions on climate change. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by Clear Mobile Internet. Clear's 4G WiMAX network covering Philly is designed to allow users to stream TV, movies, or public radio all over town. Clear, now covering Philly. Information at clear.com.
Baltimore duo Beach House thinks of making albums as more than just writing songs.
They're love children, basically. You know, they happen because they have to. It was bursting out of us, I think.
That's Victoria LeGrand, one half of the indie pop group Beach House, our guest this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
A proud supporter of WHYY, Bryn Mawr Trust has helped families and businesses manage their wealth since 1889 with investment management and comprehensive trust, estate, and wealth transfer strategies. Details at bmtc.com.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about global warming, climate change, and moreover, our attitudes about it and what we can do about that. My guests are Robert Gifford. He's a psychology professor at University of Victoria in British Columbia. He was on the American Psychological Association's task force on the same topic. Anthony Leiserwitz is a research scientist. He runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. But first, we're going to hear from Dan Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology at Harvard, author of the best-selling Stumbling on Happiness. And we're going to hear about how our minds are wired to react to certain threats in general and why it's been such a challenge for us to do something about global warming. Let's listen.
You have to remember the human brain didn't appear on the planet yesterday to deal with threats like global warming. It appeared on this planet hundreds of millions of years ago in a different form, and it slowly evolved to deal with the kinds of threats that our ancestors faced. And we're really good at dealing with those kinds of threats. If a tiger showed up your door, or a terrorist with a bomb, or somebody threw a baseball at your head, your brain is excellent at getting you out of the danger. The problem, of course, is that many of the threats that face us now are not of that kind. So it leaves us apathetic. And the reason it leaves us apathetic is that the kinds of threats we face today are not the kinds that our ancestors faced, and our brain just doesn't recognize them as threats at all. In a sense, we're sailing a very new sea with a very old vessel. Our brain is optimized for a world that we don't live in anymore. So our brain is very good at responding to threats as long as they have all or at least most of four properties. They need to be intentional, and by that I mean they need to come from an intentional agent, preferably a human being. Two, they need to be immoral. They need to ring our moral alarm bell, if you will. They need to be imminent. They have to be about things that are happening right now, and they need to be instantaneous. That is, they have to happen very quickly rather than unfolding slowly over time. When a threat has these four properties, we deal with it just as our ancestors would have, with maximal force and cunning. But when it lacks these properties, it kind of sneaks in under the brain's radar. It doesn't ring the alarm system, if you will. And some of the threats facing us today don't have any of these properties. Unfortunately, atmospheric chemistry just doesn't feel like a moral issue for most people. It doesn't make our blood boil, at least not figuratively. And so we find it very hard to get worked up about it. You know, we may be angry about global warming, but we don't feel nauseous or dishonored or disgusted. And those are the emotions that make people spring into action. If global warming were actually caused by gay sex or by the practice of eating puppies, then most Americans would be wanting to do something about it. Global warming is happening now, but most people aren't seeing any effects of it. And what they're told is that the effects are down the road. 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, we're going to see polar bears disappear. We're going to see cities underwater. Well, to the human brain, 40 years is a whole long time. If anybody thought that Lower Manhattan was going to be underwater by Friday, they would be caring about it a lot. But the brain isn't evolved to care about the distant future nearly as much as the near future. So we care more about the lunch we're going to eat in 1 hour than the fate of our grandchildren because it's so far down the road. Finally, one of the problems with global warming is that it's happening very slowly. Environmentalists say global warming is happening fast. Well, it's happening fast enough to threaten us, but if it were happening just a little bit faster, then we would probably do something about it. So unfortunately, some of the biggest threats to our well-being as a species are slow, they're in the far future, they're not moral threats, and they're accidents of nature. They're not plots developed by other human beings to harm us. As a result, our brain finds it hard to get very worked up about these things. I mean, there are plenty of people who are very worried about global warming and are trying to do something about it, and they have the same human brains that you and I have. So although the brain doesn't naturally respond to these kinds of threats, we can use our reason, our prefrontal cortex, the front of our brain, the new part that enables us to think abstractly, to look into the far future, but it isn't in our nature. And so rather than asking people to think in a way that's very unnatural to them, I would think as a psychologist that we would be wise to frame the issue of global warming so that it does indeed trigger the alarms that the brain has over eons evolved. Global warming certainly can be thought of as a moral issue. It can be disgusting that people are going to lose their homes, that refugees are going to be marching out of countries that are suddenly going underwater. These are moral issues that have tugged at our heartstrings. But instead, global warming is talked about as a rather dull lesson in atmospheric chemistry, and that's just not going to raise anybody's ire. people need to be concerned. And if they wait to be concerned until climate change is at their doorstep, it will be too late to be concerned. There are certain kinds of threats you have to foresee, not just see, but foresee. We have to use our power to look deeply into the future and respond to something that right now is only hypothetical. It's a very difficult thing for us to do, but we can do it. It's just hard.
That was Dan Gilbert, professor of psychology at Harvard, author of the bestseller Stumbling on Happiness. I want to turn to you, Anthony. You know, there's one way to look at this interview with Gilbert, and you can feel pretty hopeless and pessimistic. I mean, part of the message is that our brains aren't advanced enough to deal with this issue.
Well, I agree with everything that Dan says. I mean, we both come out of the same basic research tradition, and absolutely we're much better at dealing with immediate threats like a tiger than we are with long-term threats like climate change. That said, on the flip side, the good side is that we have developed a cerebral cortex and the ability to think and to reason and to look into the future. It is one of the few things that really distinguishes us from many other animals on the planet. And it has given us this incredible ability to build cities and cathedrals and our entire civilization. So, I mean, I don't believe that human beings are incapable of dealing with this issue. And just to give you three quick examples of very similar kinds of issues that we've managed to deal with that are often in the distant future are hard to imagine. I mean, why do people buy fire insurance for their homes? I mean, most people have never experienced a catastrophic fire in their home, and yet we go ahead and we do it. We pay good money every year to insure our homes. Why do we do this? Why would we waste our good-earned money on some possible long-term future? Because we know that we don't want to face the catastrophe. We don't want to lose everything if that catastrophe hits us. So we've built up huge industries around insurance, about making sure that we're protected in the case of worst-case scenarios. Smoking. Smoking is the kind of a thing that happens very slowly. You get the instant gratification of having a cigarette now, but over the long run, we now know through much scientific work that you are damaging your likelihood of survival. Oh,
okay, so we have the mechanisms in our brain. But one of the things, and I'm going to turn to you, Robert, one of the things Gilbert said is we have to reframe the argument to make it a moral issue, to make it more imminent. Well, how do we do that culturally? How do we change global warming into what we did with cigarettes? We were very successful with that.
Well, one of the kind of frightening things about that, I think, is that, again, cigarettes are very tangible sorts of things, very subject to social pressure and social norms. And the whole argument about the brain, although completely true, ignores the kind of social psychology of what goes on and people, what kind of circles that people are in. So that the smoking thing, first of all, it took a long time. It took about over 40 years from the Surgeon General's official report till, and we still haven't reduced smoking to zero. It's still 16, 18, 20% smokers. So the frightening part for me is that it took 40 years for the smoking thing to happen. The other side of it, of course, is that there's a lot of social factors in there, social comparison. We'd look at other people to see what is the right thing to do. There's a huge social factor of perceived inequity. Well, you know, that other country is not doing it, that other industry is not doing it, why should I do it, et cetera. And so I think we have to consider the broad social factors as well as the brain factors.
Yeah, we are social animals. Let's go to the phones. We've got Beth on the line.
Yeah, in terms of a social factor, I think one of the most important pieces in all of this is increasing over time disassociation with nature. We started out as an agrarian society, and I was fortunate enough to grow up on my grandparents' farm. And as I grew up and went through the years where Earth Day was introduced and we became more aware of the environment, I had that sensibility because on a daily basis, you know, we grew what we ate. I understood that connection. So many people now have no idea where their food even comes from or how it gets to their plate. And if you have that disconnect with the vitality that supports your life, I don't understand how people can be concerned. They just don't see the things that people live close to the land do see on a daily basis. And that's what I think is a piece that's missing in all of this, our separation from the land that we come from and the land that supports us.
Well, can you imagine any scenario where people who don't live close to the land could still have that same love, concern, passion for it?
Well, I am encouraged in that I see this increase in people accepting organic food as a good choice. I see people concerned with their personal health, and I see a little bit more connection between what they put into their bodies and what their bodies end up looking like. And I think that might be a kind of saving grace when it becomes a personal issue, when it becomes a matter of their own health. They might understand, you know, why it's important to take care of the places where our food comes from,
well,
and then by extension, where we live.
You raise a very good point, and I thank you for your call. Anthony, I want to turn to you. You know, Beth talked about, you know, people who are concerned about their health, eating organic food, so on and so forth, and this raises a class issue with this whole argument here. You know, that people on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, you know, they're more worried about jobs and food, and you know, they can't afford organic food, let alone pursue it. So, you know, does much of this boil down to a class issue? Do people have the luxury to worry about climate change?
Yeah, what's interesting is actually it doesn't. And this is both true across race and class. Our work shows pretty strongly that, in fact, people who are tend to be poorer and people who tend to be minority often care more about climate change as an issue than do middle-class whites. And that's really interesting because it kind of cuts against a common assumption is that, like you just said, minorities or poor people just don't have the ability to care about these issues, or that because the movement has been predominantly led by, you know, white men, that they don't see a place for themselves in it, and that's certainly true. But what's interesting is that, at least in terms of our research thus far, you know, people of color and people who are poor are more vulnerable, and they recognize that they're more sensitive to environmental hazards on a whole range of hazards, not just climate change. And as a result, that leads them to be much more concerned about it because they do see the human health impacts right in their own neighborhood.
Well, but let's talk about how we shift attitude to behavior, and that's a tremendous leap. You know, when we talked with you earlier, you talked about the film The Day After Tomorrow, which was released 2004, and it depicts a new ice age that gets triggered by climate change, one of these catastrophic movies. Did the movie change any attitudes?
Well, the movie we found actually did change attitudes. We did a national study 1 week before the movie came out, and then several weeks after it played in theaters, and then again 4 months later to see for long-term effects. And we found that, yes, that film, believe it or not, actually did have a significant impact. People who saw it were more likely to believe climate change is happening, human-caused, a serious threat. They said they were more willing to change their own behavior. Now, did they change their own behavior, though? That's the key question. And just to go back to your point, there's long been found a gap between what we would like to do in our behavior and what we actually do. It's often been called the attitude-behavior gap. And so we found, for instance, that on some things, people are very good at actually doing what they'd like to do. So, you know, most Americans say that turning off unneeded lights is important, and the vast majority do it. The vast majority of Americans turn off their electronics. But when it comes to other things, like using public transportation or carpooling or walking or biking instead of driving, buying locally grown food, composting, reducing their trash, they're much less likely to do those kind of things. And that goes back, this last point is to Robert's point, which is that it's not always just about our attitudes, what we want to do. It's about the system in which we live. If you don't have a clean, affordable, and safe and convenient public transportation, you're very unlikely to use it.
Hmm. We've got a caller on the line who addresses this issue, I think, right on point. Susan?
Yeah, Yes, thank you so much,
sure.
Dr. Dan. 30 years ago, I recorded some television programs regarding global warming, and we haven't moved very far from those days. But when you look back at the issues of acid rain, we actually changed behaviors and at a costly measure to change how we emit gases because we were seeing our beloved statuary and art and buildings being destroyed by acid rain. We need similar images to impact people to convince them that global warming really is real and has an immediate impact on us.
Well, I want to take that and turn to Robert. Susan, thanks so much for your call. One of the findings of the task force was we need more than images, that people are more responsive to doing something about climate change if they can see immediate savings in their pocket from energy saving devices or weatherizing their home, for example. So we do need more than images. We need something concrete. We need to be able to see and feel some kind of payoff.
Well, I'm glad Susan raised that because where I live, it is visible. Vast swaths of British Columbia's pine forest have been devastated by the pine beetle, which has happened because the winters haven't got cold enough to kill the beetles. And it's all the people who live in the central part of British Columbia can just look out their window and see a huge sea of red trees instead of green trees. These people are concerned about climate change. They see it right outside their window. And I think other people in other areas will begin to see this kind of change. And Susan's right. I mean, well, all of us would agree, I think, that it's very important that people actually see some kind of impact. But in some places, people are seeing impact today.
We've got to take a short break, and we'll come back and take some more calls. We're talking about climate change, global warming, what our attitudes are about it, why we are not doing something about it, and perhaps why we are and what we can do to change that. My guests are Anthony Leiserwitz. He's a research scientist, runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. Robert Gifford is a psychology professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
ChristianaCare's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center, a National Cancer Institute-selected community cancer center, supports WHYY. The Graham Cancer Center offers a team approach to cancer care, access to clinical trials, and personal care coordinators who guide patients throughout treatment. The Graham Center, a contributor to the National Institutes of Health's Cancer Genome Atlas Project, has expanded its facility on the Christiana Hospital campus in Newark, Delaware. Full details at ChristianaCare.org/cancer.
When broadcast journalist Bruce Johnson suffered a heart attack at 42, he decided to make it a wake-up call for others like him who never thought they were at risk.
I wanted to write a book from the patient's perspective, and that patient who didn't see it coming, who thought that youth trumped everything.
Survivor Stories, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about climate change, our attitudes, and our behaviors around climate change. My guests are Anthony Leiserwitz, research scientist, runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. Robert Gifford is a professor of psychology at University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's also a member of the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Psychology and Global Climate Change. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Ted on the line. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. I just thought it was a good idea to consider the relationship between the different extremes when we're talking about public attitudes. And I think that it's very possible that the doubters, for example, react to what the alarmists say and have the alarmists put this issue out into the public. And I really don't think that helps the cause. I've been following global warming since the 70s. I still believe in it, but I've actually you know, things haven't happened that I was told were going to happen by the turn of the century. So I put that in the category of the type of hype that causes some people to then be skeptical about the political motives of some of the claims.
Are you one of them? Have you become skeptical?
Well, no, I still believe in it. I think the issue of whether it's human-caused is also another interesting point, because some people have an inability, I think, to believe it's happening because they don't believe it can be human-caused. And I think if we can separate even the causes and the actual facts about whether it's happening from the political motives, I think we could probably get further along in the dialogue.
Interesting argument. Very interesting argument. Thanks so much for your call. Anthony, what are your thoughts about that, separating the two arguments?
I really loved Ted's comment there, and thank you, Ted, for raising that, because we do find that. We find that at both extremes, we find a group of alarmists who have apocalyptic visions of what global warming will bring. They say things like it's going to cause death of the planet or it's going to kill all life on Earth, which go way beyond the worst case, the scientific projections. I mean, it's a very serious problem, but it's not going to wipe out all life on the planet. The cockroaches will probably be just fine.
I was just going to say, and those beetles up in Robert's neighborhood will probably stay.
And on the flip side, the dismissive, many of them are adamantly opposed to it because of it's an assault to their identity. They hate what they hear out of, say, the environmental movement, or that they absolutely don't trust anything Al Gore says. I mean, Al Gore could come out with a press conference tomorrow and say, you know, scientists have discovered that the Earth is round, and some of them would say, well, then I don't believe it. I mean, I'm, you know, exaggerating, right, of course, but you get the point, is that these kinds of politics, of the conversation or the shouting at the two extremes really does a disservice to the reality of the issue and, in fact, where the vast majority of the public actually is, which is, again, believing that it's happening and a serious problem and that we'd like somebody to do something about it.
Robert, I want to turn to you. The American Psychological Association, the task force, called on psychologists to take a bigger stake in climate change. What can we do as psychologists? What can I do as a, not a radio host, but as a clinician? What can I do? Should it be part of my work in psychotherapy?
Well, I should. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Certainly, some of the other members of the task force are clinicians, and they deal with people who feel personal depression or anxiety severe enough that they need to be dealt with. This is a one-on-one kind of level, which, you know, is not going to change the problem, but it might help those individuals. At the more policy level, however, I think the important contribution that psychologists can make, again, is to help learn more about how framing the issue will lead to more commitment. As Anthony said, you know, the big problem is people saying it's a problem versus actually doing something. And we need probably different messages for the different six Americas or other countries as well. Remember, this is a global problem, although the U.S. and Canada are the leading emitters, but we need messages for different countries as well and for different segments of North American and European society. And that's where psychologists are good at understanding how to frame messages. And this was a lot of the success in the smoking campaign, although, as I said, it took a long time, was learning how to frame the message ways that worked.
I think that's well said. I think that's a great answer. Anthony, I want to come back to something I brought up early in the show, and that's about thinking locally. That's something you said. We have to think locally about climate change. But what's that mean? You're in New Haven. I'm in Philadelphia. Help us understand what thinking locally would be different for you and me.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that actually has been very little reported, is just the fact that climate change can, in fact, be detected all over the country. In fact, the U.S. Global Change Research Program just released a great new report called The National Assessment of Climate Change in the United States, Climate Change Impacts in the United States. And anyone can go online and see what is already happening in their region of the country. And we see that. It's not just pine bark beetles in Canada. It's pine bark beetles all throughout the American West. I mean, if you fly over the American West right now, you can just see it in the Colorado Rockies, in Arizona, huge, you know, thousands of acres that have been devastated by by those insects.
Well, you're asking us to go online and do research when when most of us aren't all that motivated in the first place. Let me ask you to address a different population. I want you to address our listeners who might be, as a result of the show, more concerned, more motivated, want to do something besides recycle their own trash. Give them marching orders. What should they do, we do, today, tomorrow?
So the one thing that you could do that's more important than anything else to reduce your own carbon footprint is to insulate your attic. I know it doesn't sound sexy, but that is where more energy is lost than anything else. Weatherizing your home. If you want to buy a more fuel-efficient car, fine, but not using your car one day a week would make an even bigger difference. And then to a completely different behavior that really is crucial, because for all the individual behaviors we might do, that cannot solve the problem in the end. It's part of the solution, but ultimately this is a system problem. This is a problem that's going to require national legislation and national action. And if people really want to see the world deal with this issue, it has to come through the political system. So they need to call their congressman, they need to contact their representative, and let them know how they feel about this.
Well, they are great and doable marching orders, and I appreciate them, and I appreciate both of you taking the time to be on the show today. Thank you so much, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for inviting us, yeah.
My guests have been Robert Gifford and Anthony Leiserwitz. Gifford's a psychology professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He was on the APA task force studying the connection between psychology and climate change. Leiserwitz is a research scientist. He runs the Yale Project on Climate Change. And he's one of the principal investigators for the Global Warming Six Americas study. Well, next week on Voices, we're going to be speaking with Carl Morlantis. He's a Vietnam vet who returned after the war to a world that he didn't understand, and he has written a novel called Matterhorn that he says took him 40 years to write. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. This show is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell me more.